Regular listeners will know that Stephen De Silva is a guide at St Albans Cathedral and was formerly a warden, one of the wardens. Stephen's been in a number of times now talking about different aspects of the cathedral and of local history. When you were talking about the immortal screen some time ago, you mentioned somebody called Lord Grimthorpe, and there was a touch to what you said there. That
if you gather a group of cathedral guides together, there will be those who will cheer for Lord Grimthorpe and there will be those who do not cheer for Lord Grimthorpe. I sometimes call him Lord Marmite, because you love him or you hate him. Maybe today we could do him a bit of justice and say there were some good things that he did in the cathedral, but he was also really quite a strong character who brooked no disagreement with his plans. His real significance is that he spends a lot of money repairing things in the cathedral. I'm not going to say restoring, because he wasn't a restorer. He liked to pull out medieval work and replace it with his own stuff. He's a really important part of our survival.
Let's just go back, place this in time. What we're talking about. We're talking about somewhere in the 19th century.
We are, yes.
Not long after it became a cathedral.
Around about that time, he moves into St Albans in the 1850s and 60s. He builds Batchwood Hall. That was his house. So if people know Batchwood Hall. And he is really part of the Abbey Restoration Committee. Now, the person who's really caring for the Abbey in those days is the wonderful Giles Gilbert Scott. If you know St Pancras Station, you know one of Scott's greatest buildings. Scott was very sensitive. He liked to restore the medieval past, but not kind of damage it or replace it. And Scott is in charge. He's the architect of the cathedral from 1856 until his death in 1878. So that's just when it's becoming a cathedral, 1877. It becomes the cathedral. And it's when Scott dies that Grimthorpe begins to get the upper hand. Up till then, Scott seems to have been able to put his plans into effect.
Is it like there's sort of a group of trustees that are in charge of this?
Local worthies, typical. So the Earl of Verulam was on the committee. Of course, the bishop and the dean, once it became a cathedral. The rector, before he became the dean. Good local worthies. And Grimthorpe, being a wealthy resident of St Albans, he was a lawyer by trade. That's what he did as a profession. Had a lot of personal wealth from his family, who were industrialists from the north. So he kind of inserted himself into the committee as a volunteer. But soon his very large personality starts to take over the committee. And he starts to try and persuade people to do things that probably weren't very good for the building, you know.
What was the point of it all being done? I mean, was the building falling down? Or
when the building was bought by the townspeople in the 1500s, St Albans bought it. But of course, St Albans was a tiny town, and this was a huge church. And so particularly the nave of the building, the western portion of the building, was falling in. I mean, there are paintings of big holes in the roof. And there's a little boy who writes in his diary in the 1820s about seeing barn owls flying around the nave. Parts of the building were open to the air. It was in a pretty parlous state. It needed saving. The walls were splaying outwards by 2 feet. There were all kinds of plans put in place to save St Albans Abbey.
And so it needed money from rich people.
Whether it had become a cathedral or not, it was in a parlous state. Becoming a cathedral helped because people were more willing to give money to it. But the big debate was how you restored this building. Did you do it sensitively by trying to keep everything that was there and just patch it? Or did you pull down what was there and rebuild? Scott was a patcher and a sensitive restorer. Grimthorpe frequently said, oh no, this is too rotten, pull it down and I'll build something in its place. And so some of the elements you look at today on the cathedral, they seem out of place and a bit heavy-handed.
Let's come to those specific places in a moment, but just to get a sense of, Scott was the architect and he died. Grimthorpe was not an architect. What was he?
He was a lawyer. He was an amateur architect. He had great skill. I mean, I think, to be fair to him, amongst the guides who do and don't like him, he had great mechanical skill. He was the ultimate clockmaker. He made Big Ben, the clock. It was said that at 5 years old, he took apart a pocket watch and put it back together again. So he clearly had a mechanical mind and mechanical skill. But that's not the same thing as being an architectural restorer. And I think it's a good example of somebody who promotes themselves beyond their actual skills. As an engineer and as a mechanic, he was probably a very fine one, and a lawyer.
So what were the first things then that were done? I mean, you talked about the nave being in poor state. Was that the first thing that was...
Actually, just things like getting the roof repaired.
Fundamentally, it was the same shape as it is today.
It is, yes. Added. The footprint of the building was pretty much what it is today. But basically, if you think of the four ends of the building, particularly the west end and the north and south transepts, those were in a very fragile state. And they did definitely need repair work of some kind to make them good again. So the first thing is to make the building building watertight, repair the roof, and so on. A lot of that is done by Scott, very carefully done. And then Scott has this wonderful plan, it's a very important plan, to put the walls upright again. They'd started to splay outwards. Imagine the walls of the cathedral splaying outwards 2 or 3 feet. Not surprisingly, that's what made the roof unsteady. So Scott had this wonderful plan, very ambitious, to pump the walls with hydraulic pumps back into position. Lift the roof, pump the walls back up, and drop the roof back down on the walls again. Fantastic plan. No one had ever tried anything like that before. And Scott died just before this plan could be executed. So Grimthorpe, who very quickly seizes control and gets permission from the bishop to, in effect, become the amateur architect of St. Albans Abbey, he actually executes the plan of pumping these walls back into place. It was regarded as amazing. It was front page of the Illustrated London News. St. Albans Abbey is saved by these walls being pumped back. Lord Grimthorpe, the saviour of St. Albans Abbey. Nowhere is it mentioned that actually it was Scott's plan. Scott had done all the work on it. It was just Grimthorpe carrying out Scott's plan. So Grimthorpe was portrayed as the saviour. It's really Scott who's saving the building. Unfortunately, after that, I think the glory will have helped Grimthorpe think even more of himself than he did. So he then goes on rather to do very grand things. Things which we today look at and probably think are rather lovely, like the western end of the cathedral, the Great West End. It's dramatic. Architectural purists will tell you it's a fantasy. It's no one style. It's several styles rolled into one. But the key thing is, Scott had said, for £200, I can save the west end of the building and keep that wonderful medieval window. Grimthorpe says, no, that's not possible, you know. And Scott's dead and in his grave. So Grimthorpe pulls out this medieval window and completely rebuilds a rather grandiose western end to the building for about £20,000.
It's quite a lot of money in those days.
But then Grimthorpe had a lot of money, and he who pays the piper calls the tune. And I don't think it's surprising that the bishops and the deans had to, in a sense, acknowledge that Grimthorpe was funding a lot of this.
When you approach the west end, there are all sorts of figures and carvings on those walls surrounding, leading you into the doors through which you pass.
Yes.
That's all the new stuff.
If you look at the actual doors, the physical wooden doors, there's a little bit of masonry work around the doors that is medieval. Everything else is Grimthorpe. He builds out, he inserts, for example, there's only a central door in the Middle Ages, but then he inserts to it side doors. He carves lovely figures. In fact, there's a good story about those, because as you go in the central porch, it's the four evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And Matthew is always portrayed as an angel. And it's the oldest, ugliest angel you've ever seen, because it's Lord Grimthorpe. He commanded his face to be carved in as the angel of St. Matthew. And some said it was because he knew he wasn't going to have a memorial, that he was so disliked, nobody would ever erect a memorial to him. And that's true, they never did.
The original West End was completely different from that?
It was very plain. It had a large perpendicular window in the centre, a gorgeous window. But yes, it was a very plain ending. And you could argue that raising the building to cathedral status demanded perhaps a slightly grander entrance. But if you look at it, you know, there are these, what we call these pepper pots on either end, these rather funny turrets. They're stylistically nothing to do with St. Albans Cathedral at all. And he did this elsewhere in the building. There was some, the abbey was battlemented. Imagine a castle with battlements and turrets. That's how it had been made by the Normans. And there was a Norman turret that was perfectly secure and didn't need replacing. But Grimthorpe argued with the Dean, Dean Lawrence, that this was rotten and had to be pulled out and replaced. And so that's a classic Grimthorpe thing.
If he doesn't like it, he says it can't be saved.
Yes, he basically says it can't be saved. He had skill in building, that's no doubt. But he didn't seem to have skill in restoring. He also just, in principle, didn't like medieval work. He regarded the medieval age as kind of super. He was quite anti-Catholic, for example. So the kind of Catholic revival in the Church of England with stained glass and statues and that kind of thing, he really loathed. He put three big windows in, two of which he designed specifically so that they couldn't accommodate stained glass. And he'd have been furious that 20 years after his death, that's exactly what people did. They put stained glass in. He would have loathed that.
Is he responsible for those deceptive windows?
That's, I think, one of his most successful windows, actually. The windows on the south transept, the deceptive ones. From the inside, the five lights look the same height. From the outside, the five lights are of different heights. And that's because above the roof in the cathedral is an attic room. And those lights are higher on the outside to let light into that attic room. Now, that window genuinely was rotten and needed to be replaced. And I will give him that. And he did something very sensitive. He kept some of the older glass that was there. Some coats of arms of people, William IV and others, and he retained that glass. That's a really good example of sensitive work, actually. He did other things. He employed a very good carver called John Baker down in the Lady Chapel, carving flowers and fruits. I don't want to be the kind of, you know, he was all bad, but he was heavy-handed in other places.
Well, he had the money, so without the money, perhaps nothing could have been done.
Indeed.
So the nave's been done, the walls have been lifted with this magical industrial concept. Those buttresses on the outside, are they...
They're his as well.
They're his as well. Yeah. Was that
because... But that was planned. That was planned, yeah. You would have needed... Once you got the walls back up, you needed to support them.
So sure it didn't happen again.
Absolutely. So those buttresses were essential. Because there had been a history of collapse at St. Albans, and you can see that over the centuries, really.
Okay.
So that was good.
So what were the areas that were not touched at this stage? Was the choir...
There was very little that wasn't, to some extent, modelled or remodelled. He doesn't do much within the building itself. Lord Aldenham, as we talked about once before, restores the great high altar screen. Other people pay for other repairs within the building. He tends to work on windows and the exterior, but also the Lady Chapel. He puts a new roof on the Lady Chapel and a new floor. So sometimes we talk about the Lady Chapel as a medieval sandwich. You know, the centre is medieval, the bread is Victorian. But he does make it secure, so we have to, you know, we have to be grateful to him for that. But no, not within the building. He doesn't tamper too much within the building. He's a great one for doors and locks. And in fact, some of the finest doors in the cathedral are Grimthorpe's doors. But he did do something very naughty with another door in one of the clergy houses. He constructed a door to the lavatory. And this lock on the door to the lavatory could only be opened from the inside if you'd flushed. Can I just read you a little bit from his biography? I just think it's rather nice, isn't this? Because he caught out a very significant person. Grimthorpe devised a lavatory door lock by which, once the door was shut by the entrant, it could not be opened until after the cistern had been flushed. This diabolical machine was installed in St. Albans, maybe at the rectory. The bishop came to the house in question to examine a flock of ordinands. The young gentlemen were lined up at attention. Finally, after a long wait, they were sent to search out for the bishop. He was located and told what to do in order to get out of the small room in which he had found himself inexplicably incarcerated. The unhappy bishop was exposed as a habitual non-flusher.
The watchmaker has turned to a lockmaker.
Yeah, and Grimthorpe would have loved that because he loved pulling a joke on someone else at their expense. They weren't kind jokes.
We mentioned the first bishop with whom...
Well, the person you really fought was the first dean, Walter Lawrence. The bishop was a little bit more sympathetic towards Grimthorpe, but the bishop was a slightly older gentleman who kind of just, you know, for an easy life, and because Grimthorpe promised the money. But the first dean, Walter Lawrence, was a stronger character, as was the Archdeacon Grant. And Lawrence and Grimthorpe frequently fought. I mean, you know, so Grimthorpe often accuses him very unfairly of base motives in behaving in this way, and you're just doing this to challenge me. Grimthorpe held grudges. When Lawrence was finally installed as Dean of the Cathedral in a grand ceremony, Grimthorpe said he was too ill to attend, but observers noticed that he wasn't too ill to be waiting outside, ready to pick up his wife after the service. Mm-hmm. Just a way of saying, isn't it, I don't forgive you.
One of the things that amuses me is you say he was anti-Catholic. He would be turning in his grave if he had one, as it were, there, because you have Catholic Mass.
Oh, yes. I mean, he would be horrified that there's a Friday Catholic Mass. Any turn in the Church of England towards tradition and Catholicism was loathed.
What else did he do that was particularly naughty? Or?
Well, towards the end of his life, and we are talking only a couple of years before he died, so maybe his mind was failing, he asked to borrow a box of letters. Now, the Lady Chapel had been restored by subscription, and many women, because it was the Lady Chapel dedicated to the Virgin Mary, many women had particularly undertaken to pay for this. And one of them was the First Lady of the Land, Queen Victoria. So there's this wonderful box. There was this wonderful box of letters in the Abbey archive from all of these women, including the Queen. And he asked to borrow the box to look at the letters. And so this was loaned to him. And either because he forgot or because it was just Grimthorpe's cussedness, he instructed his nurse to burn the contents of the box because he could use the box for something else more useful. So this wonderful letter from Queen Victoria is consigned to the ashes. How sad. How sad, really. Yes, his mind was beginning to fail, I suspect, towards the very end. He dies in 1905. And one of his descendants, one of his nephews, wrote down that apparently, rather sadly for a man with such a great life, his final words were, "We're running low on marmalade." So, you know, I think he wouldn't have liked history to have recorded that after such a great and wonderful life, such perhaps trivial or mundane words.
Well, you've talked about the judgments that you, as a group of guides, make.
Yes, yes.
Stand around shouting about whether this man was a good man, a bad man, or both.
That's a very good description.
What about the opinion of the professionals, those who looked at it from a historical point of view or architectural point of view?
Well, I think there are two opinions, and again, they sum up, you know, the attitudes that people have. One was the great guide writer Pevsner, Nicholas Pevsner, who wrote a series of guides to the counties of England, architectural guides. And he says Grimthorpe was a venomous, pompous, righteous bully. Well, Pevsner never does put his words when he doesn't like something. But I'd rather use these words from Dr. Eileen Roberts, the late Dr. Eileen Roberts, who wrote a very good architectural history of the Abbey. And I think she's much more balanced in summing him up, but accurate as well. Grimthorpe had exemplary ideals. Know what you're doing. Build well. Be bold. Be strong. But he did not know his limitations and never listened to his critics. His great qualities were marred by arrogance, bad taste, and a lack of historic sense. Like us all, he was human, but his strengths and his weaknesses were on an heroic scale. I think that's a really good summing up of the man.
It's quite a nice epitaph.
It is.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Always great fun. Look forward to next time.
Thank you.